This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I am talking to Janice Nimura, who is the author of Daughters of the Samurai, A Journey from East to West and Back. It's a wonderful book about a really, maybe a completely unknown to Americans, a story about young women from Japan coming to America in the 1870s. Hi, Janice. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
No, it's really a pleasure. I really like this book. I thought that you brought them to life in a really good way, and it's a difficult thing to do because you're talking about two cultures, but also two cultures of over 100 years ago. So you had to travel in time and geography, cultural space. You know, I think it must have been a challenge for you.
It was a challenge, but it was also ecstatically fun. And I think, yes, there is time travel involved, but one of the wonderful things about studying 19th century history is how familiar it starts to feel after a little while. Yes, it's 140 years later, but there's an astonishing amount that's very familiar and similar about how people react to each other. And in fact, I think one of the surprising things about looking at this period and this sort of cross-cultural moment between America and Japan is how open-minded both sides were in this moment. We tend to think of ourselves as having invented cross-cultural exchange, but it was very alive and well back in the 19th century, in some ways more so than now, I think.
Although, as you point out, and we can go back and sort of talk more about the details of what happened, but when there were five Japanese girls, you know, they were not women yet because they were really young, who were selected by the new leaders of Japan in this period to come to America. And they made this incredible journey, which you recounted really beautifully. But when they come to America, they are looked at as objects, they're looked at differently and kind of as objects of interest rather than as people.
Certainly. They are exotic. There's almost a sideshow quality to them, especially the girls. The girls were sent over as part of the largest and most prestigious of the embassies that, as you say, the new Japanese government sent out in the 1870s to kind of learn everything about everything in the West and help Japan catch up, because Japan was coming out of 2.5 centuries of relative seclusion. This embassy, the Iwakura embassy, reached San Francisco in 1872. And although the 100 or so statesmen on this embassy had acquired Western clothes, and some of them even had a significant amount of English, these five girls that had been scraped together and sent out didn't have either. So when they appeared in public, which was fairly rare once they were in America, they appeared in their gorgeous kimono without a word of English, and with a chaperone who was the wife of the American ambassador, who kind of enjoyed this sideshow sort of attention and didn't do very much to help them win some camouflage, some Western dresses, or help them to communicate. So it was a very uncomfortable phase of the journey where there was kind of a P.T. Barnum aspect to the way they were looked at first.
You can only imagine. I mean, it's just impossible to imagine what it must have felt like to be 10 years old, essentially ripped from your home and sent away, and thinking about just what it was like to travel in 1872 across the Pacific Ocean, an amazing journey, just incredible.
Exactly, especially since the youngest of the girls wasn't even 10. She was 6 when they left, and she was 7 when they arrived. And then they, you know, after a couple of weeks in San Francisco, they set out on the Transcontinental Railroad,
it was brand new.
Right. I mean, this was something that most Americans hadn't imagined doing yet. And these Japanese girls were on their way, crossing from coast to coast.
No, it's just, I mean, and I guess we should probably go back to the very beginning, because you, in order to set the scene for this story, you have to go back to Japanese history, and we don't need to recount the whole story, but it's a really interesting period as well, which I think a lot of us don't know the details of, and that is, you know, where the essentially the traditional emperor And the way and the shogun, the ruling of the country was had been completely upset and changed, which includes all of the feudal system being broken apart, so that these girls were all children of the losing side in what had essentially been a civil war.
Exactly. This story is a perfect lens through which to understand what's known as the Meiji era of Japanese history. So 1868 to 1912, which is the lifetime, the rule of the Meiji Emperor. And 1868 was the year that the forces supporting this young emperor overthrew the shogunate, which had the military dictatorship that had ruled Japan since the beginning of the 1600s. And this new group of statesmen with this young emperor as their symbolic head were filled with energy to end this period of seclusion and embrace the idea that Japan could be a player on a global stage and win the respect of the mercantile nations and not suffer the fate of, say, China, which was, in the throes of enslavement to opium and had been victim of the opium wars. And Japan was determined to protect its own sovereignty. And in order to do that, they realized very quickly they had to catch up. And they did in the space of the lifetime of this emperor. Between 1868, when he was installed, and 1912, when he died, not only was the feudal system dismantled, but every system was renovated at the highest level. So let's take legal systems from France and naval technology from Britain and industrial techniques from America, and let's put them all into play so that by the turn of the century, Japan was actually winning wars against places like China and Russia.
Right. But also going through that entire period, wanting to retain its own culture and not become something that they weren't. So there's all this tension between conservative and older ways of cultural, the way the culture had been built, and yet the new influences coming from outside. It's got to be a really interesting period.
Exactly. It's like an identity crisis on a national scale, and with all of the back and forth, the turbulence that you expect from that, and it, a lot of it is almost comical. I mean, you get questions not just about big ideas like industry and military technology, but things like fashion. Are we going to keep wearing kimonos, or are we going to start wearing top hats and leather shoes? The art and the culture of the period is an extraordinary mix for a decade or two, and then the conservative reaction starts to set in, and all of that pendulum swing, that ebb and flow, is fascinating to watch.
And of course, I think what you observe in what I, or at least what one of the takeaways for me is that most of the modernization culturally is taking place among the upper levels, the ruling classes, the wealthier side, the wealthier spectrum of the society. They're the ones who are sending their children away to America or to Europe. They're the ones who are ending up running the country. I mean, there is some movement from people who were not necessarily at the top at the beginning of this period, but for the most part, a lot of these people are, they were the better off classes of.
Certainly, certainly. But there is also this upheaval where what used to have been a very rigid hierarchy with the samurai, the bureaucrat class, the warrior class at the top, and the merchants at the bottom, the merchants were the ones who, during this upheaval, had the skills to be opportunistic and nimble and were able to change quickly, where the samurai were more rigid and old-fashioned and often really sort of fell apart because in this new era where they had to make a go of it by themselves, they didn't really know how. So there was a little bit of a social inversion going on at the same time. But you're right, the scholars that were going out to America and all over the world on these embassies were almost uniformly of the samurai class, as were these five girls who were chosen from samurai families.
Right. So let's talk about the girls because they're really the heart of the story. And it ends up, that only three of them stay in America, two go home. So
Right.
your book focuses ultimately on those three and their story is pretty amazing. I mean, you actually covered an incredible length of time in this book. And I didn't feel like, you know, it's not a tome. So you really, I think you did a great job of taking us through the entire lives of three women.
Well, you know, I think I'm a big believer in learning history via story. And the best way to do that is to hang on to the coattails of interesting characters. And these three women, who start as a 6-year-old, a 10-year-old, and an 11-year-old in 1871, just happen to be three fascinating people, just as people, regardless of era or whatever was happening to them. They're just interesting people. And happily, they did a lot of writing over the course of their lives. So when it came to trying to figure out more about them, their own voices were very much still, you know, accessible in their own writing.
What do you think the writing, is that sort of, that's part of, I mean, that era for particularly women, I think, in who are educated and had, and of course, you know, this is the primary means of communication.
Sure.
is writing, because you're, you know, especially if you're they end up going back to Japan after spending 10 years in the United States, and they kept in touch with a lot of the people that had been important to them.
Right. And, you know, they were lucky to find themselves in really supportive and loving families. And the letters that they wrote after they left, yes, they wrote them because that's what you did back then. But they also wrote these letters out of a need to share the emotional upheaval that they were going through. You know, they'd spent 10 years in America. They'd arrived here in 1872 with no English at all. Not even any Western clothes. 10 years later, they had lost most of their Japanese-ness. One of them could no longer speak, the youngest one, could no longer speak Japanese at all. And when they left and found themselves back in Japan, really struggling to figure out what to do with these American skills they had grown up to learn, their letters became sort of the only place they could put their emotional turmoil. And so the letters they wrote home were letters about their struggle, about there's nothing obvious for us to do here now. We can no longer read and write Japanese. We miss so much some of the freedoms that we took for granted in America. We are determined to fulfill this mission we feel to help our mother country, but we don't know how to go about it. And so they put all that into their letters because there was nobody in Japan to talk to about it and no language in which to talk. So that was an added extraordinary sort of side benefit of their strange circumstances for me, because they wrote these letters that were just saturated with their emotional state, more so than I think most Victorian letters usually are.
Well, that's true, but also they were writing to, in some cases, to other women who they felt were sisters. You know, they were sisters, the families mm-hmm. they grew up in, or their surrogate mothers, the people who took care of them.
Exactly.
So they had the opportunity to be emotionally honest, and probably you're right that I keep thinking about how complicated their lives must have been. And, you know, you go, it's sort of this yo-yo effect. First, you're displaced from your culture when you're really young. You're taken to this new country. And it's pretty good. As you said, they were, I think, you know, kind of by definition, the people that took them were people who had the means to do it, and also the interest and sympathy and understanding at heart. So they were in really good circumstances. They end up going to at least the two older ones go to college, and the youngest one and graduates from a really good high school. But they were with other people who were pretty wonderful, and accomplished on their own.
Yes, yes, and who really supported this idea that there was a very worthy and high level project at hand here. You know, in a way, these families were sort of acting as missionaries with missionaries in place. They sort of were being missionaries without leaving home. They were raising these girls who were going to go back and bring their American Protestant upper middle class intellectual values back to a place that they considered less civilized. And at the same time, they just really engaged with these young women as people, not just as subjects, but as really as members of the family. And they did that really from the start, which was unusual. Leonard Bacon was the Congregationalist minister who took in the oldest of the three girls in New Haven, Connecticut, and he actually put it in writing in a memo to the Japanese representative in America, saying, "I intend to look after this girl as if she is my grandchild, not as if, you know, she is some servant or lodger or foreign student."
Well, and of course, her what amounts to being her foster sister became involved for her entire life with the with Japan.
Right. So Alice Bacon, who was the youngest of Leonard Bacon's 14 children.
Right. He was something, I think he was 70 or so when this first happened.
Right. Exactly. He was not a young man. He was a patriarch of the New Haven congregational scene. He commanded one of the most prestigious pulpits in the area. He was the pastor of the Center Church on the Green in New Haven. And he embraced this project with great enthusiasm.
And Alice Bacon. Well, anyway, so what I wanted to talk about was to just sort of continue this kind of idea of them being displaced repeatedly. So they're displaced by coming to America. Then they become very American, even though they are still very Japanese. When the time is up in America, and I don't want to gloss over that completely, but they do have to go back to Japan. And because the Japanese government had sent them here, as you said, on a mission, they had a goal, and they wanted these girls to come back and do something to bring what they learned back to Japan. So
right.
now they have to go back, and as you said, they are no longer fully Japanese. They've been raised as Americans, and they have to come back and essentially relearn what it means to be Japanese. So, you know, we often talk about people who live between cultures. You know, you may be raised in one, but you're living in another. But they have this really interesting, really complex issue of being raised in one, then raised in another, then going back to the original one.
That's right. And, you know, the older two who both grew up in New Haven families were always near each other because they were in New Haven together, and then they were both at Vassar College together. So even though they lost their literacy in Japanese, they always were able to converse and practice their Japanese and keep it from rusting completely. They also had been slightly older, 10 and 11, when they left Japan, so they had more vivid memories of what their lives there had been like. So when they returned, they weren't starting completely from zero. The youngest one, though, who left Japan when she was 6 and was the pampered only child of a couple in Georgetown, in Washington, far away from the other two, she really lost all of her Japanese. She returned to Japan without a word of spoken Japanese and with really the mindset of a spoiled middle-class American kid. It's very interesting to read her letters early on because her perspective has this funny dissonance in it of an American kid, basically, who still understands that she is Japanese and has a duty to fulfill to the Japanese government. It's an interesting thing to watch.
Well, yes, and she become well. So the story of when they come back is really interesting. So Sudomatsu, who's the Sudomatsu, and then Shige. Mm-hmm. Shige is plays. She's really more of a musician than an intellectual, it seems to me.
Correct.
Sudomatsu is really pretty intellectually advanced, and you know, does really well in school. So,
right.
But they both come back, and as you said, they were older. They're kind of expected to join Japanese society now, and what ends up happening is they both get married.
Right.
And to major, you know, it just in some ways to major people in Japanese society at that point. But what Ume, who is the youngest one, and I think she becomes sort of gradually the focus of the book, because she really stands out for what she ends up doing. And maybe you could talk a
Right.
little bit about her.
Sure. Well, she of the three, she's the only one who remains a household name in Japan. I mean, you study Umetsuda in social studies in elementary school as one of the heroes of the Meiji era. Because eventually she ended up founding what became one of the most prestigious women's colleges in Japan. It's called Tsuda College now. But at the time when she first returned to Japan, she was 18. She had no Japanese. She had no intention of marrying, partly because of this cultural alienation. You know, how could you imagine marrying a man that you couldn't talk to?
Well, and also that it's still in Japan at that time, women were made to be subservient to men, so that if she were to, what she envisioned was marrying a man becoming no longer a, you know, a self-directed person.
Sure. Although, you know, her friends, Stematsu and Shige, the other two of this trio that were so bonded to each other, they had both married men who had significant international experience and understood that, understood their marriage and their wives in a more sort of modern, slightly more egalitarian way than an average Japanese man would have. So she did see that it was possible to have a marriage where there was room for achievement. She just wasn't having any of it. Partly it was that she of the three had embraced Christianity the most strongly while she was in America. And when she got back to Japan, she couldn't get over her horror that men drank on Sundays, you know. So it was a big barrier. She also just... Well, partly because she had been so young when she was spending those 10 years in America, when she got back to Japan at 18, she settled into teaching English, and after a few years realized that she hadn't gotten to have the experience of going to college in America as her two friends had at Vassar. So she returned to America and did a few years of study at Bryn Mawr College, which was also a very young institution at the time. And I think at that time she really also imprinted on Bryn Mawr's leader, M. Carey Thomas, who was a woman, a formidable woman, an educator with a capital E, who really gave Ume this sense that staying single and forging a path as an educator was possible, even for somebody in Japan. And then Stematsu's foster sister that we mentioned before, Alice Bacon, was another really important model for Ume. She, Alice, also had remained unmarried and had become an educator. She was the she was an assistant principal at the Hampton Institute in Virginia, which was an institution founded to teach the children of freed slaves. So between these two women, she really had a sense that a life alone in education was possible, and she actually recruited Alice to come to Tokyo more than once and help her and teach with her, work with her. So she was able to stay true to this path of going it alone, which was really unusual and looked askance at by most of the people around her in Japan at the time. Even though she's seen as a hero now, her contemporary peers then thought of her as way outside of, you know, conventional society.
Right, because she didn't marry, and she also actually built something. I mean,
right,
that,
exactly.
Yeah, so...
There was no mold for that.
Right. No, she's a very interesting character. I thought about her a lot. And, you know, the relationship between her and Alice is kind of emotional. It's more than just sisterly, I thought.
Right. I think they really, they inspired each other in a rather deep way. Alice learned published a very well-received book, more than one book, but an especially famous book called Japanese Girls and Women with Ume's help, that became kind of the go-to text on Japanese women for Americans for decades.
And then Ume, she actually dies very young, I thought, in her 60s, but Alice, who's there by then working with her, ends up staying and takes over running the school.
Actually, that's a different woman, a woman that
oh.
she met at Bryn Mawr by the name of Anna Hartshorn, who becomes Ume's... Alice dies a little bit earlier because she's a little bit older than
right,
Ume,
right.
But...
Yeah, I've conflated those two women.
No, of course, it's easy to do. Anna, but Anna's another interesting character. Anna is somebody that befriends Ume at Bryn Mawr, and then comes out to Tokyo at Ume's invitation, and as you say, ends up spending decades, long beyond Ume's death, helping to run Tsuda College, and is really, I would say, probably the most important relationship in Ume's life. They become important to each other in a very intimate and profound way.
Right. No, you definitely get that. And of course, it's so odd in a way that she becomes almost in the modern, I mean, she is, Anna Hartshorne ends up being in Japan until 1940, comes back to America, and then can't go back to Japan, of course, because the war breaks out.
Right.
But she lives on. And so, you know, you think about the way that history connects. She's alive into the modern, what we consider the modern era, you know, almost,
right,
you know, post-war America. So she is the link to this period of time that's now really seems old and distant to so many of us. But it shows you how history kind of connects across generations in a
right.
really interesting way.
It becomes
way.
A bridge. And you know, for me, part of the ecstatic fun of doing this research was meeting some of the descendants, some of the people who, you know, for instance, Anna Hartshorne's great nephew emerged from, you know, just spontaneously. He saw a notice about this book and contacted me, and we've met. You know, I at this point, I've met relatives or descendants of every major figure in the story. And, you know, even though, you know, it wasn't as if they all had troves of letters that were relevant necessarily, but even just connecting with them, hearing how the stories had come down to them within their own families was a magical experience to sort of see how the influence of these women had cast different glows over their families. I mean, certainly the descendants of Stematsu and Shige, who each had several children, there was definitely a tradition of cosmopolitan multiculturalness. These were families where, you know, studying abroad remained an important value in the family 100 years later. And I just found all of that fascinating, and I felt really honored to be able to access it.
Well, that is amazing. Well, and I should have mentioned this at the very beginning, but you also have a kind of cross-cultural experience. So I imagine that for you, this was resonant in a particularly personal way.
Exactly. I mean, this story is oddly personal to me, even though none of these people are remotely related to me. You know, I grew up third or fourth generation New Yorker, but I had the good fortune to marry a man who was born in Japan and had lived most of his childhood in America. And then after we were married, right after college, we moved to Japan for a few years to sort of find out what that was going to mean for us in our lives together. So this idea of moving between cultures and of growing up far from where you begin, as my husband did, and also for me of diving into a brand new culture and trying to belong in it, as Alice did on her stops in Tokyo and as the girls did when they returned to Japan, it was all very personal, in a funny way. These were not trunks of letters that I had found in my own grandmother's attic, but in a funny way, they had more to do with my life than I could possibly have found within my own family.
So, and are you able to read Japanese, or can you speak Japanese?
I speak Japanese at the sort of family level. My husband's family always kind of laugh that I sound like a 10-year-old boy when I speak Japanese, because that was sort of the age at which my husband stopped growing in Japanese. He's fluent in Japanese, but he also speaks a rather simple version because all of his education and most of his growing were in America. So I have this funny this funny calf to the way I talk. And although I read some Japanese, I was very grateful that when the girls grew up and moved back to Japan, all of the writing they did was in English because they had lost their Japanese.
Ah, right, of course.
It's a great gift to me.
Of course. No, that's really good. Well, in some ways, your experience in speaking Japanese must be similar to theirs in both speaking English and in speaking Japanese. You know, they were at different periods, they were also, you know, at that stage of not being completely fluent, but knowing enough to be able to communicate.
Right. No, it is. It's very similar. And it really, it made reading their letters and reading, especially the letters of their immediate arrival in Japan, very, so familiar to me. You know, Umetsuda writing back to her foster mother, "I wish I could speak my own language. I'm so tired of being underestimated. You know, I'm so frustrated because people assume that I don't know very much because I can't communicate with them." And I knew exactly how that felt when I arrived in Japan at the age of 24, you know, fresh from a rather intense education and ready to prove myself. And the assumption was that I was my husband's wife, and
Right.
that was pretty much it.
Oh no, it's so, I mean, language and culture are very complex for us, and the communication is, I mean, you see this happens all the time with people who come to America from other countries where they're very well educated and very accomplished, but because they can't speak English fluently, they are thought of as being not intelligent, you know.
Right.
If people make judgments that are just incredibly wrong, but that's, you understand why that happens.
At the same time, you also learn very quickly how quickly you can learn a language when you have an intense and urgent reason to do so.
Well, that's true. And of course, you did mention there was this wonderful point in the three girls' experience in America where they realize that they're, by keeping them together, they're able to communicate and they don't need to learn English. So they have to be separated, which is unfortunate for them, but obviously true. You know, they, in order for them to really engage in an American culture, they could not continue to be Japanese and speak Japanese.
Right. Although they did, you know, maintain, even though they were separated, they maintained this bond, this bond of their trio, that lasted until their death. They were intensely important to each other for the rest of their lives because there was no one else on earth who had experienced exactly what they had experienced.
No, that's true. The bond that you, there were scenes near the end of the book where they're older and their families have grown up and they're, you know, they get together, they work together, you know, that Ume engages the other two women to help her, but they are, you can tell that they have a special relationship that really probably no one else on earth could share.
Exactly.
So this now, I know right now you're in the stage of talking about this book and, you know, traveling around and doing events. But I guess I have two questions. One is there anything that you worked on in this book that you didn't include that would spur you to do another project? And did something else come along from this that you just couldn't include in the Daughters of the Samurai that you could do something else with?
I don't know if there are things that would expand into other books, because I feel like I used most of what I found, kind of wrung it dry for this book. But there were storylines. I mean, the thing about nonfiction is that you have to put a frame around it somewhere. And there were storylines that, you know, were tantalizing, that I just, that were just outside the scope of this project, that I wished I could pour myself into figuring out and had to leave. You know, things like Alice Bacon, when she spent her first stint in Japan in the late 1880s, teaching alongside Umetsuda, when she returned to America in 1889, she took with her a 5-year-old Japanese girl who was Umetsuda's distant cousin, I believe, and raised her as her daughter in America for the next 10 years, until she came back to Japan at the turn of the century. That's a story that's a wonderful echo of the initial story that I really wished I could pursue more of, but there just was a maddeningly thin amount of documentary information about this little girl that came with Alice back to Virginia and grew up as her daughter. I mean, that's the kind of story that, you know, what I need to do is turn myself into a historical novelist
Right. No,
and do
that I
another
agree.
book there.
I was just thinking that that's a novel. The reason that you could write this book is that there was so much documentary evidence. There's so much actual material you could get into because they lived both, they not only wrote letters to each other, as you talked about, other people around them wrote about them. You know, they were public figures,
Sure.
and you don't always get that. So with somebody like that little 5-year-old girl, No, I think you're probably stuck. You'll have to become a novelist to
exactly.
to take
well,
on her.
Those are the limitations of writing narrative nonfiction, is that you have to work with what you have, which can be frustrating because it can be tantalizing, but it can also be liberating because at a certain point you say, there's no more.
Right.
You know, those letters were lost and I can't find them. So
right.
I have
there's
to
only
here.
Right. That the story is what you have. That's mm-hmm. all what you were given. That's true. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a different thing to do nonfiction than fiction, clearly. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you about Daughters of the Samurai. It's a terrific book, and I will look forward to your next book, whenever that is and whatever it will be about.
Thank you so much. This is a great pleasure.
Thanks, Janice. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Janice Nomura about Daughters of the Samurai, a great book.